Two topics today, Stonehenge and sex. And some of you are saying, where's he getting to the sex? Okay, let's start with Stonehenge. I want to tell you a little bit about Stonehenge. This is Stonehenge, as John Constable, the romantic English painter of the Romantic era, painted Stonehenge about 180 years ago. Now, you can look at Stonehenge and you go, hang on, that's not quite what I anticipated Stonehenge looks like on Salisbury Plain. It seems to be a little bit more, it looks like someone like myself with OCD got to it and tidied it up a little bit. And that's exactly what it looked like 180 years ago, according to John Constable's painting. And you may only have seen a picture of it, but it obviously doesn't look quite like that. Some of the stones are lying on their side, and it's all a little bit tipped over, as you would be after a couple of thousand years, I suppose. Now, if we could have the next slide, that'd be great. This is, in fact, people in the 20s recapping some of the stones of Stonehenge and cementing them into place. This is true. This is not like men not walking on the moon and stuff. This is actually true. I remember listening to SBS, watching it on the TV on the news, and they had a story about this, and they went around the streets interviewing people about, could they actually believe that cranes were hoisting those thousands of years old things that have been on, sitting there forever? It's deeply spiritual. That was actually in the 20th century that we sort of figured it up and constructed it a little bit to tidy it up a little bit. And the responses were, no way, through to, I like to believe they were always like that. I like to believe that they were always like that. The problem, of course, is what you like to believe and what you believe are two different things. But also, it's a bit hard when you only ever see it the way it is to actually think that it could have been any different. And all the art students, you know, looking at the tall phallic symbols, and all the engineering students are looking at the cranes. Earth-moving equipment at so many levels. But anyway, it seems almost impossible to believe that the reality currently in front of you has not always been the reality. That, in fact, in the recent past, another reality was not only probable, but was actually the case, long before your reality ever came to being. And I would say that's also true, not just of Stonehenge, but of sex. And the reality that we have in the Western context about sex is also a long way from the reality, still in great swathes of the world, that don't seem to matter as much to the front pages of newspapers from time to time. So when I say to you that in the past, even in the Western world, sexual intercourse was valued primarily, not exclusively, but primarily, for its role in procreation and cementing a marriage relationship, rather than simply pleasure or finding the person who's going to fulfil your life in the context of intimate adult consensual relationships. That can seem a bit like saying Stonehenge wasn't always like it is, because that's just the world we inhabit. That's just the way we've always known it. Except, like Stonehenge, it's actually true. It's actually true. Which is all a way of saying that because sex is such a hot button topic in our culture, from gender wars to marriage wars to hetero, homo, whatever, we need to take a certain level of what I would say chronological humility to the task of looking at sex. It wouldn't go astray to say, okay, let's just for a little while suspend my framework of thinking about it and crank that back a little bit and think, is what's behind some of the issues that I think about when I think about sex and where it's placed in our culture? Is it possible that the way we think about sex in our culture today is not only not the only perspective, but is an idea landlocked by presumption, unable to conceive of a different reality? It's a bit like getting a postcard from Stonehenge from someone who's visiting the UK, putting it on your fridge and saying, that's how it's always been. Mowed lawns, Stonehenge neat on Salisbury Plain, and a motorway in the distance with little cars on it, which you can see from Stonehenge. Rather than sitting in the grass with John Constable as he sketches in the early 1800s what the reality actually is. And the point of these talks is, what do you crave? And the central thesis was that you're created to crave by God. You're designed to desire, and Christianity is not about curbing your desires, but about redirecting them. And you're also shaped for sex, and to a large extent, shaped by sex, especially in this context. And other talks on this, the other three talks are more general, aren't they? It's about happiness, which can sort of, it's a wide semantic field. And it's about belonging. But sex sort of narrows it right down, doesn't it? It's got a semantic field, but it's not so wide. Why so specific? Is it because sex sells? Is it because you're uni students? I think part of it's because sex is a mainline drug. It hits your veins and goes straight to you. That's the point of sex. That, you know, if your craving is, you know, holidays in Vienna and it costing $20,000 and 6 months to sort out, and that's your idol, just holidays all the time in exotic places, that takes a bit of time. But sex can be much cheaper and much more available. And it's certainly a mainline drug. And you're not going back to Vienna in 3 days' time. So if you're not a Christian here today, we're not picking on sex, nor are we suggesting let's go back to the good old days, because there were none. The story of the Bible shows that there were no good old days about how sex worked, except for one period in the Bible, which we'll look at. You see, this isn't the aha moment where you go, I know where we're going. We're going back to the traditional values where women knew their place and men were in the workplace and, you know, things could happen that would be swept under the carpet and sex was this way or no way, and it was repression and keep quiet about sex. We've been there, done that, we're not going back there. Well, the culture won't go back there, let's face it. But many people are saying the biblical perspective has been tried and found wanting, but I would say for often in our culture it hasn't really been explored and looked at and tried. Unless you think that I'm saying that sex is just simply relational and functional and to keep a marriage cemented together, just simply that, though it is that, I think we need to celebrate the universal appeal of sex's, I suppose, sexiness in that respect. Listen to this great poem. Art students here? Art students? They're the ones late at the back. William Carlos Williams. William Carlos Williams, anyone? Writes this poem entitled, "This is just to say that I've eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold." You think, that's not about plums, come on, you know. Yeah, it's about plums. How cold was that icebox? I have to make them so delicious. But William Carlos Williams ostensibly wrote that as a post-it note on the fridge. But it's launched 1,000 theses because it's such a sexualized kind of language. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold. Yet at the same time, he says, forgive me. There's a certain ambivalence, isn't there? Forgive me for that, but it was great anyway. That's what comes into it. There's that ambivalence. That's the history of it. Let me read you from the Bible, from the wisdom literature of Israel, which you'll have in front of you. It's the part of the Jewish and the Christian scriptures, the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon's, chapter 2. "As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." And I saw a cartoon which shows a bishop standing there saying, what spiritual application can we get from this rather sexy chapter? You know, because obviously fruit and sex are going together in... Isn't it interesting how the cultural thing happens? That there's one poem, William Carlos Williams, the fruit, literally, of secular middle Western 20th century culture. And there's a second poem, which is the fruit of the religious middle age or middle Iron Age culture. Thousands of years apart. But there's a thread that runs through these poems. If the traditional world of sex and relationships was about marriage and procreation, it was served up with a good deal of erotica. See, the Bible doesn't shy away from sex. either in eulogising it when it's right or warning about its sorrows through both narrative and law and proverb when it goes wrong. So in light of that, three short things about sex this afternoon. Sex isn't everything. Sex isn't nothing, but sex is something. Sex isn't everything, it isn't nothing, but it is something. Why this? Why am I picking on those? Well, see, the Bible has helpful things to say about sex to a world that's very confused about it. Let me explain. Anthony Eastland, the professor of English at Providence College in the US, is a graduate of English from Princeton, and he says this in a book. We are now in the odd position of supposing that sex is too trivial to require virtue for its exercise, but that it is simultaneously so significant, so determinative of a person's identity, that to suggest any restraint upon its consensual exercise is an affront to the most important fount of human dignity. It is at once nugatory and holy. We are at once to think nothing of it and everything. It is once like scratching an itch and worshipping a god. It requires no sacrifice from its exerciser and the sacrifice of everything else to it. Nothing on one side. Everything on the other side. How do you navigate through the middle of that? Well, sex isn't everything. Let's pick up what he says. We are at once to think nothing of it and everything. And in our culture, we're making sex carry a lot of weight. It's become everything. To suggest restraint upon consensual sex is an affront to the most important foundation of human dignity. That's where our culture is at the moment, I would have to say. And 20, 30 years ago, talking with people at uni about Christianity, the questions of universalism were much higher up the food chain. What about this God? What about that perspective? Now you talk about it, it's about what do you think of this aspect of marriage or that about sex? It's come right to the forefront. And the touchstone of individual freedom in our modern world has three taboos. Don't criticise someone else's life choice or behaviour. Don't behave in a coercive, harmful manner towards others, and don't engage in a sexual relationship with someone without his or her consent. You see, taboos in a culture allow you to sort of have the parameters to flourish. And these are the taboos of social engagement, which allow sex to have a much wider parameter than the Bible would actually say. You see, sometimes when the soil is fertile, a plant can flourish in it. But when it's too fertile, when you overdo it, the plant can grow too quickly, too much fertilizer, and it can boom and bust. Plant grows too quickly and collapses anemically under its own weight. And in a culture in which sex is everything, of course everything becomes sex. And it loses its edge, doesn't it? It becomes anemic and collapses under its own weight, advertising cars, refrigerators, and ice creams. To paraphrase the evil syndrome from the movie The Incredibles, when everything is sexy, nothing will be. But see, isn't that a long way from that passage? His fruit was sweet to my taste. Refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. And unless you think it's all euphemisms, later in the story, the bridegroom-to-be, because this is about a marriage, gets to the point. He says, your two breasts are like twin fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. Can't imagine saying that to your spouse, but Jill may have said it to me recently, but hiding in the reeds. You see, the Bible was Bring Sexy Back long before Justin Timberlake got to the Mickey Mouse Club. Let's face it, it's true. So what about the Bible and sex? See, the Song of Songs highlights the Bible's view of sex as something to rejoice in. And if the Kama Sutra gave us, from the Eastern philosophical framework, gave us a sex manual, right? In Song of Songs, we have a love anthem. It's U2's One, and Hunters and Collectors, Throw Your Arms Around Me, wrapped into one. There's pleasure and procreation. And when I said at the start that humans were created for sex, have a look at the second reading. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep. This is from Genesis, the first book of the Bible. Caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, of course she's fit, basically, as I said yesterday. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. He sees the immediate symmetry between them and he celebrates it. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to a wife, his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Now that's a good start, isn't it? But human rebellion after that in the stories of Genesis starts to incorporate bad relationships and the hint of bad sex, in the sense that by Genesis 5, Lamech has two wives, a rival wife already, which is a long way from what God had said there. So already humans have decided that they can meet their cravings in different ways. There's always the reality of bad sex lurking in the Bible, whether that's a woman being raped and her brothers destroying the town in which she was raped, killing all the men and stealing everything. Whoa. That started a fire they didn't realise would end that way. See, the Bible never shies away from sex, good or bad, even among the supposed heroes of the story. The Song of Songs is set in a context. As you look through the Bible, it's roughly there in the middle, which is telling you that something good has gone wrong, but something good remains. But perhaps there's something better further along the track. The story isn't finished yet. The context of the Song of Songs has the tension, the sexual tension, as a couple wait for marriage. And it's also got the tension of the Bible and its understanding of human relationships and intimacy. There's a problem at the start and there's fulfillment promised at the end, where the tension will be resolved fully and finally. And the last verse of that from Song of Songs says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles of the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now there's two possible understandings of that last line. It could be wait until marriage. And in this context, that's exactly what it would mean at one level. It's a marriage text. But it's also an intimacy text. Don't disturb intimacy. This is an exclusive text. It could also mean one way or the other. Don't disturb it until it's ready, or keep away from intimacy, someone else's intimacy. There's a warning in that text. And whether or not you agree with the perspectives on sex, there's a lot of sexual tension held within that text. A sexual tension that will be fulfilled, but is held nonetheless. The Bible can hold that sex is not everything, while still, and I would argue, can, because of that fact, give sex its due weight, its due importance, and even more celebrate it. Sex isn't everything. But sex isn't nothing either. Anthony Esalen's line, we are once to think nothing of it and everything. You can see how if sex is made to be everything, then ironically it's on its way to being nothing. And the caricature of the Christian view of sex, as I said, is it's evil, nasty and dirty, save it for the one you love. That's the caricature. But the other problem is the dualistic worldview that says there's the spiritual world where you have the higher thinking and it's all to do with your relationship with God, and then there's the flesh world. It doesn't really matter. The Greeks were very much into that thinking. The world of mind and concept and the world of appetites. Get on with life and get it on, bang a gong, in the midst of life. It's just sex, right? No. See, the Christian God is the God of sex. The Roman God of sex was Venus. The Greek God of sex, Aphrodite, and the Hindu God of sex, Kama, and his wife, Rata. But the Christian God of sex is God. The creator God, sustainer God, deliverer God, warrior God. There's no compartmentalizing with this God, which is why the sex stories of Song of Songs is right there in the Bible. You can't divorce sex from its impact on the rest of life because God won't allow it in the bigger story. What happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas with this God. in any area of life, particularly with sex. Now, Richard Dawkins has not covered himself in glory these last few months. I think he's getting dottery. I mean, he looks like he smells of old corduroy, doesn't he? He just does. So taking a pot shot at Richard Dawkins at the moment is a bit like shooting cows in a field with a high-powered rifle. It's too easy. I can do it anyway. Because what he said... If there is a God, why would he care about what we do with our genitals? The subtext is, and nor should you care about what you do with yours, unless it involves heavy machinery or whatever. But in a sense, that fits with cultural taboo number three, doesn't it? Not to engage in a sexual relationship with someone without his or her consent. So it sounds fine for our culture, and maybe Richard shouldn't delete his Twitter account just yet. Unless you want to sit in my wife's clinical psychology practice one day and listen to the woman almost driven mad by the fact that the man that she was having consensual sex with for 20 years and three kids and a mortgage is now having consensual sex with someone probably young enough to be her daughter. No taboo broken there. Or the Midland druggie mole, who my wife also sees as a clean psych, who consents to sex with bikie gang members because her druggie boyfriend can't pay the debt. And so she is the debt paying out to them. Those bikies have got the best lawyers. They'll make it look consensual, I can tell you that. Well, the time my wife worked in a maximum security prison where dozens of men were doing life for murder because their wives were having consensual sex while they were off in their FIFO job somewhere. You see, I think if there is a God, what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. I think God cares about grief-stricken women, drugging moles, and murder. That doesn't answer everything about consensual sex, but at least let's not pretend it's nothing. Let's not go there. Instinctively, in our gut, we know that's not the case. Finally, sex is something. Ultimately, I think the main reason that Richard Dawkins gets it wrong when he says, if there's a God, why does he care what we do with our genitals? The ultimate response is this: because God grew a set and came down here. Seriously, Jesus the man. There's a saying in the building industry, you build a house for your enemy, then you build a house for your friend, then you build a house for yourself. If you're going to create, then you're going to end up having that, you better sort it out first time around. And I think God did. But God grew a set and lived among us in the person of Jesus. Jesus the male, I suppose. We call it the incarnation. Like chili con carne, meat, personage. When God created us, he created us with genitals. He wasn't blasé about it, not least of all because he knew he was taking on humanity. Jesus lived as a male of the species, and the resurrection of Jesus proves that he's still a male. Jesus is not ashamed of our sexual nature. Because sometimes when we think of Jesus, we think like the mannequin in the shop, you know, the male dummy. It's got like a cricket protector at the front of it. Doesn't have anything else there. You sort of think, you know, the disciples were saying, well, when he's going to have a pee, is he actually going to have... I mean, you've got to think about those things. God became a man. A male of the species. God has an interest in sex and in your sex because he is its creator. But not just a male, is it? It's a man. Jesus is not simply the male of the species. He is, in his humanity, a man, part of the male and female set that God created for humans. There was an infectious song from the Bloodhound Gang many years ago. Those great noble tradition of you and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals. So let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel, which is a fantastic theological framework if you think about it. If you think line one is true, we're just mammals, therefore line two is obvious. But let's back engineer it a bit Is that true? Mammals? Male and female, yes, to some extent, but not simply mammals. Men and women made in the image of God. Jesus was a man. He got hungry, tired, and he had cravings. Yesterday, please give me a drink, he says at the well. And whilst he never had sex, he was, funnily enough, by all accounts, the most complete person anyone had ever met. No one was going around, you know, that Jesus, he really needs to have sex because he seems so unfulfilled and no one really wants to hang around him. It's not the way it was. Jesus is proof that you do not need sex to fulfill you, to complete you, or to be completely satisfied in life. But even if you do, it's not the ultimate thing in life. Yesterday we said it's taking a good thing and making an ultimate thing is where the problems with cravings lie. Now the movie The Last Temptation of Christ by Martin Scorsese, filmed with Willem Dafoe, was placarded outside many cinemas in the US and boycotted by many Christians. But I actually think it's a brilliant film because I've heard an interview with Martin Scorsese about it. And he said he wanted to show that the obvious temptations for Jesus that Satan came to him with, power, money, power without suffering, glory without suffering, they were big. But perhaps the biggest temptation might have been the least obvious. Here's a man tempted to just live a normal life, who women found attractive because of his character. And he might just want to settle down and have intimacy and steady relationship. And the movie is about Jesus on the cross imagining that life. I won't give it away. Obviously, he says no. That's Jesus the man. He could have settled for so much less. But he put aside his manly rights, so to speak. No cold, delicious plums. No refreshing apples, no sweet fruit. But the bitter mix of wine and myrrh on the cross. And even that he refused. If Adam was naked in the garden and felt no shame, in order to restore us from our own shame, Jesus was naked on the cross and shamed. Forget that loincloth. The Romans didn't do it that way. He was exposed for all the world to see on the cross, the complete loss of intimacy, to restore intimacy to its rightful place and to offer us back forgiveness and healing where we need it in this area. If ever a man had the right to give in to a good craving, it was Jesus on the cross. But he gave it up, not for his own satisfaction, but for ours. But for ours. So that cravings such as belonging, sex, purpose and happiness would not become mindlessly chasing after the wind, but would first and foremost be met in God, who gives sense to all the other cravings and the way we crave them. Sex isn't everything. It is nothing, but it is something. But here's the final thing. The marriage in the Song of Songs does have a spiritual application. Our last reading, Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. The holy city, New Jerusalem, is code language for God's people, those who belong to Jesus. Coming down out of heaven, prepared as a bride. You see, if I was writing Revelation 21, I'd say, as a business colleague or a business partner and, but a bride, a partner for life, God's not ashamed to use that language to describe his relationship with people. And it doesn't say when he sees them, he'll shake their hands. It says he'll wipe every tear away from their eyes. That is intimacy at a very deep level. And not just for this life's satisfaction, but into the age to come. Ultimately, we were shaped for sex because we were shaped by and for satisfaction in God. Thanks, people. Anyone got any questions? We've got 2 or 3 minutes before I think we have to vacate. Any a seriously complex question that's going to take me 30 seconds to answer? Sorry? Where I'm from? My accent. Are you just picking on me now? I'm from Northern Ireland. Yeah, long time ago. The more nervous I get, the more I sound Northern Irish. So today I was very Northern Irish. One question? Sir?
So in my experience, I talk to a lot of male colleagues who are striving for purity in a world that is, built to glorify sex. A common reaction is to try and, crush sexual drive and desire, which I don't think is particularly helpful. What do you think is a good mindset to have in that respect, in directing sexual desire?
Well, when it says in the Bible, do not be overcome by evil, but suppress it. No, it says, but overcome evil with good. Think now, how do you hold the tension of something in a culture in which people, if they want to, if a lot of Christians save sex for marriage, Christians should, I believe. When you're getting married at 30, not 20, how do you resolve that? Now, obviously, that getting married doesn't solve some of your sexual problems. Let's face that. I think it has to be something that's a little bit more open between Christians talking about it. I think that's our taboo sometimes. We don't talk about it. We don't encourage each other in purity because we see it as a solo thing. And this is one of the taboos that we say in our culture is, you can't tell anyone how they live sexually. But we live as a community. We do, and Christians do, to speak with each other about how we live sexually in God's way, because the rest of the culture is saying something the opposite. I think you have to have a group of people to begin with from a mindset that say, my plausibility about how this works is just as plausible, if not more, than what the world is offering me. I think because we are created as sexual beings, the physiology says, hey, you're at the peak of that. But let's face it, you can also redirect your focuses and desires from many other aspects of life as well. It's not as if sex is just some monster that's just completely uncontrollable. That's not true. That's the myth of the culture that get that sorted out and that'll sort everything out. That is simply not true. As an overeater would tell you, that sex isn't the only appetite that's uncontrollable if we let it be. I think that's crucial. It is obviously a big appetite and one that is innate within us. But it's not that it's not controllable. A Christian would say that we have the power of the Holy Spirit. So I would say, in community, being open about it and recognising that it isn't the monster that it wants to be in your mind. It's not actually that. Part of the issue. I think marriage is good too. From a Christian perspective, I always say to Christian young people, if you're not going to have sex until you get married, then don't. Get married to someone who you love and you think that you can stay, you're going to commit your life to. And Christians are seemingly to be getting married younger than the rest of the culture. Not only because of that issue, but partly because of it. That's a vague-ish answer, but if you need to press me on that. One more question, we've got time? No? Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.